This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's been a long time since I've been this excited about a new natural medical innovation. Zona Plus is the real deal. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662 or tryzonanow.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And, you know, there's lots of ideas about diets. There's the low-fat diet. There's the high-fat ketogenic diet. There's the gluten-free diet, as exemplified by William Davis's Wheat Belly, FODMAPs, Paleo, you name it. Today we're going to talk to an expert who takes the view that diet does matter, but not the way we think. He's the author of a book entitled The Diet Myth: Why the Secret to Health and Weight Loss is Already in Your Gut. I think you can see where we're going with this, the importance of the microbiome. We've had guests talking to this issue, and this book really expertly covers that issue. Dr. Tim Spector is professor of genetic epidemiology at King's College in London. He established something called the Twins UK Register in 1993. That's the largest lab of its kind in the world, where he studies the effects of nature versus nurture on identical twins. He is also interested in the gastrointestinal tract, and that's why he is the initiator of something called the British Gut Project. We're going to find out more about what that has to do with our state of wellness. So without further ado, here's Dr. Spector. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
So, you know, in the book, you talk about the misleading medical calorie dogma. You know, so what do you mean by that? Why have we gone wrong with that notion?
Well, I guess it stems from my time as an MD, seeing patients for so many years, being told by my bosses and pretty much everyone around me that obesity was a simple question of people putting in too many calories and not taking enough out in terms of exercise. And this has become a sort of central dogma that it's all pretty straightforward, in that people are fat, just have the wrong equation, and you just need to sort it out. And realizing that around the world, doctors have been telling patients this certainly for the last 40 years or so, and in that time, rates of obesity have pretty much tripled everywhere. So even if it were true, it's not particularly helpful, and I don't even think it's that true. And the more I researched this, coming from a fairly unbiased view about 5 or 6 years ago, I found really that most of the things that I'd been taught to believe as fact had very little evidence based around them, and that increasingly medics, as they don't have access to new data or don't have time to research it, just fall back on the old favorites. And I think time has come to now tear up a lot of these myths, a lot of them based around studies hundreds of years old, like calories, and like some of these facts that, oh, it's exercising is the best way to lose weight, and everyone will respond to, you know, a good diet, and everyone will lose weight. And the fact that if you get a good diet together, a calorie-controlled diet, you can predict how people will do on it. And there's the whole this question about avoiding certain foods as well. So as well as those central dogmas that I think are based on very little evidence, you've got these new fad diets, as you mentioned in your introduction, which are really focusing on people giving up foods, saying that you can solve the whole of obesity if you cut out gluten. You can solve, someone else will say you solve it by becoming a vegetarian. Another one will say by giving up dairy. Another one will say by giving up fructose. And, you know, you, if you believe them all, you basically just have a bit of kale juice and some vitamin tablets. And,
right.
You live on that. And the risk is that, you know, we're losing the point. And the point is that gut health is probably the key to reducing the obesity epidemic and this allergy epidemic.
Well, you know, that's
focusing on that is probably where we should be going. We're losing our way by these fad diets.
Right. And that's a very interesting perspective, because certainly something has changed, because we're seeing obesity rates skyrocket, not just in the United States, but across the world. I think there's a new statistic that suggests that more people are overnourished worldwide than undernourished for the first time in human history. And that's becoming more of a health problem than starvation and malnutrition. So the popular theory was what's called the thrifty gene hypothesis, which you take on in the book. The idea that we have these genes from prehistoric times that are designed basically to have us sock on weight, but it was okay until the modern era, because we had a lot of work to do. You had to really exert yourself to get the calories. And now we have all these labor-saving devices. Plus, we have hot and cold running food, so therefore it's natural that we're all going to gain weight. So we have to exercise like crazy and restrict our food intake to be okay. What's wrong with that?
I think the premise was that in the past we were never exposed to too much food, and anyone who's looked at any of these more primitive hunter-gatherer tribes knows that you'd have whole seasons where you'd have lots of food and certain people would be overeating massively. And so that really wasn't true. And the idea that we were genetically programmed in this way also doesn't stack up. So the fact that and why should we be so different to other animals as well? So that's why there's this other theory called the drifty gene hypothesis, which I think fits the data better, that there's about, in the past, we did have an upper and lower band about controlling our weight like most animals do. Most zoo animals, for example, you know, they stay pretty stable. Wild animals just don't get fat for a reason, and that was because if we got too fat, we'd be eaten by saber-toothed tigers.
Right.
But that died out, you know, over a million years ago. We lost our predators, and so we lost that upper band. We keep the lower one because of starvation, and so it's very hard. You don't progressively lose weight. Your body does everything to keep you at a minimum. But some people have lost that upper band that stops those pressures. So that seemed to fit the data better, and also fits the fact that even in the most obese places in the world, you can still find about a quarter of the population fairly resistant to it. They don't tend to get diabetes, and they don't get obesity, even in Gulf states or some of these Pacific islands. So there seems to be some people that still have these genes that even if you overfeed them, they don't get fat.
So that was
a new idea, saying that, you know, there's more. It's not just a question of eating more that we were used to.
So what has changed, however, in your estimation, although it's not, you know, clearly there's no simplistic answer to this multifaceted problem, is the state of our GI tracts. So what are some of the things that have created over the past century or so a profound change in the state of our guts? What are some of the factors that militate against optimal weight?
Yeah, well, our gut health is the one thing that has dramatically changed, as you said, in the last few decades, really, probably since the Second World War. And we now have about somewhere between a third and 50% less microbes than hunter-gatherer tribes do. And there are a number of factors. One is antibiotics. The average 20-year-old American has had about 18 courses of antibiotics. The average 3-year-old, over between 2.5 and 3 courses. And they, each time they go off, you take them, they're like a little atomic bomb going off in your guts. Too many of them, you get you start losing species forever. We've got cesarean sections, which 30% of Americans are born by now. And in some places, like Puerto Rico, it's about 60%. And that also messes up your microbes because you don't get them from your mum the way they should have done. And then, of course, you've got food. We're having, despite the greater choice when you go into a supermarket, most people are having a much less diverse diet with less nutrients in it and less fiber than we were 40 years ago and then our ancestors did. And this means that we can support many less microbes who depend on this diversity of food and high fiber food to live off. And we know that the lower the diversity of the foods we eat, the lower the diversity of our gut microbes, and the less healthy we are, the less our immune systems are working well. So it's this accumulation of all these factors together that's causing us these problems. And we know that the less diverse your gut microbes are, the more that makes you susceptible to obesity, because you can even take a non-diverse gut microbe biome from someone, put it into someone else, and make that animal obese.
That's the so-called infectobesity. There's the term has been coined that you can actually, and with an experimental animal, take stool from a fat mouse, give it to a skinny mouse, and turn the skinny mouse into a fat mouse.
That's right, and there are a couple of case reports of people who have received human poo transplants for a very bad infectious diseases, and they've ended up fatter because the donor was a bit on the chubby side.
Sounds like a malpractice case right there.
Yeah, it's a bit of a risk. You've got to make sure who you're getting it from.
Indeed.
But the serious side is that, you know, it means we're taking a different view of obesity rather than this sort of mechanistic view that it's just a question of what goes in and what goes out. And really, the microbes are in the center of everything. They're the ones digesting the food, allowing us to make different chemicals from it, and they produce far more chemicals than our human cells can actually do, and this includes vitamins and all kinds of immune cells and things that we really still don't know very little about. So encourage the more of them we have, the more, if you like, weapons we have at our disposal to keep us healthy. But at the moment we're slowly drying up that supply with processed food, junk foods, which are killing them off as well.
So by what means does, let two individuals sit down and eat a double bacon cheeseburger, and one has a diverse gut population, perhaps with certain beneficial bacteria, and the other one has what might be termed dysbiosis or a bad balance. So by what mechanism is this happening, that the same hamburger, basically the same caloric value food, same macronutrient combination, fat, protein, carbohydrates, sugars, and so on, translates to overweight in one and not in the other?
Well, we don't know the precise mechanisms, but we know that, particularly from animal experiments, that if you alter the microbes of genetically identical animals and give them the same foods, the microbes would alter the way they break down things like the meat and the fat, because they alter the chemicals, bile salts that come from the liver and the gallbladder, which are key to our digestion. So you're getting different amounts of these produced, and these have very big effects on how you break down some of these products. So you'd seem to be a very simple meal of, you know, how do you digest that beef and the meat and the fat, ends up being very different depending on the individual makeup of the microbes, because they are the ones producing the chemicals, digesting it. And they can do it efficiently, non-efficiently, slowly, or they can make different byproduct chemicals, which can have an effect making that person lay down more fat or lay down more toxins or have more inflammation. So it's this huge variety and differences between us, which we're only just realizing. A good example is we think we only share on average, 10 to 20% of our microbes with each other. And in fact, it's quite hard to find, you know, one microbe that, say, you know, 500 people would all share. Some people just lack them. We're very individual, unlike our genes. We share 99.9% of our genes with each other and our DNA, but very few of our microbes. So we're amazingly diverse in that respect, and I don't think anyone's really taken that into account up to now.
How far away are we from, you know, the holy grail of weight loss, which is personalized microbes or designer yogurts, which resupply us with the beneficial bacteria that will, in effect, burn off our fat? Is that something that within reach, or is it too complex a problem to tackle?
Well, at the moment, we know only the functions of a very few microbes in any detail. And we know there are thousands of them, and it could be that some of these rare ones are actually the ones that produce the biggest bang for your buck. So we tend to ignore those at the moment because we say, oh, that's rare, it's quite in low numbers. But increasingly we're finding that some of these do produce huge amounts of these metabolites that can be used for even, you know, medication and drug purposes. So at the moment we can just give crude advice, but even that is still pretty effective. So by increasing people's fiber intake, doubling the fiber intake, you'll get more beneficial microbes produced in your gut. And we've already started to do some experiments in our twins doing that. And we see, an increase in diversity, and we start to see some of these key microbes that we've shown in our other experiments that were important protectors against obesity being increased. Clearly, there are going to be differences between people. And there's going to be a more personalized way of tweaking that to get that better so that we can say what type of fiber people should be eating, or whether they should be having Jerusalem artichokes, sunchokes, or they should be having leeks and cabbage or beans. But at the moment, we're in the early stages of this, and it's just exciting showing that we can change the microbiome, because just a few years ago we thought, you know, it was virtually impossible to change people's microbes. Now we know you can do it in a few days.
What works better, diet change or taking probiotics or eating fermented foods? How do you reshape your microbiome? There's so many different influences.
Yes, and the answer is probably all of the above, because they all do different things. So just to explain, when you take a probiotic, you're actually having live microbes, generally beneficial microbes, a few species. And we used to think that they didn't work because they're unlikely to survive very long through the stomach acid, and you couldn't detect them long term in your guts. And that's true, but it doesn't mean they don't work. And we think that they trigger benefits in the other microbes there. So if you have a daily yogurt, that microbe doesn't necessarily stay in your gut long term, but it does promote the function of the other microbes that are resident there. So it's like,
so it might a little crosstalk. It might talk to some of the other microbes and help to orchestrate their proliferation, or their colonization.
Episodic rich tourists is how someone's described it. So they come and
sprinkle some dollars.
Money episodic. Yeah, exactly. So while they're coming, you know, everyone's happy and productive and doing things and selling hats and sunglasses and sun cream. So that's the idea of the probiotic, that it just generally increases the good chemicals given off, these little short-chain fatty acids which help the immune system. But in themselves, they don't stay. And then you've got these the fertilizers for the microbes, the prebiotics. And these are a whole range of different types of foods that are generally high in fiber. The best ones, we think, are things that are high in inulin, like these artichokes, like chicory, leeks, onions, garlic, some Mediterranean type foods, and anything high in fiber. Then you've got things like the legumes, the beans, etc. Then you've got these whole range of foods which we thought acted in a different way, the polyphenols, the flavanols, these brightly colored foods in lots of berries and vegetables that provide this chemical polyphenol which the microbes live off. And they love this, and they will convert this polyphenol, use it as energy, and then again give off in exchange these helpful short-chain fatty acid chemicals and allow other microbes to flourish as well. So you've got this complicated community living off this, in a way, community of foods that works two ways. And that's why it's this combination of having the high-fiber diets with the diversity, with the fermented foods, and increasingly people realize that some of these foods that other countries and their food cultures have eaten for centuries, like these live yogurts, these kefir drinks, kombucha, kimchi, you know, and a lot of the Japanese fermented soy type foods, have actually could be the secret to a lot of their health relative to the sort of British American style diets. So it's that variety that I think is key here, and until we understand what makes one individual respond to a certain thing, I think we've got to keep it pretty broad.
It has to be very individualized. Okay, you set the stage for a discussion of how the gut is crucial to our metabolism, to optimizing weight. The book is The Diet Myth. Why the Secret to Health and Weight Loss is Already in Your Gut. And when we return with today's guest, Tim Spector, we're going to tackle some questions such as what is the science of nutrigenomics and how can it predict whether certain foods, certain supplements are beneficial for us? Are we there yet in terms of making those predictions based on genetics? Is cheese a health food? And could coffee be a source of valuable fiber? That's all in part two, so please join us as we continue our discussion of the diet myth with today's guest, Dr. Tim Spector. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.